Friday, a weather front will push in from the Atlantic. It will be a weak affair, but certainly on Friday there'll be more cloud and some showery outbreaks of patchy rain moving west to east. That's your weather.
Thanks, Louise. And now, just before our Book of the Week, a word from Quentin Letts.
For some, they're an aspirational carpet, a quest for bucolic perfection. For others, a battleground to exercise manly dominion over nature. And for many, they're a nagging millstone, needy and time-consuming. Yet in this green and mossy land, we're obsessed by them. Lawns. We not only invented this horticultural habit, but also gave it to the world. For once, no one really does it quite as well as we do. But with all the time, cost, chemicals, the endless watering and the moles, what is the point of lawns? Do they say more about us than we ever imagined? Join me, Quentin Letts, this morning at 9 o'clock and again this evening at 9:30 on BBC Radio 4.
Now, Book of the Week, and more from Philip Hoare's new account as he celebrates a lifetime's connection with the sea. He began with a place close to home. This time he recalls a watery metropolis in the sea inside.
The suburbs slip by in a succession of deserted stations, trailing disembodied voices from unheard tannoys. Silver birch march beside the tracks, shiny as wrinkled tin foil. Plastic bags blow in sycamore branches. The train rolls on. Ever since I lived there, leaving London felt like an escape. It frightened and excited me with its streets and alleys down which I might disappear. I was defeated and enthralled by the scale and sprawl of the capital, which spread like a stain from its river. I descended into gloomy basements made glamorous by punk and all that came after, caverns in the dreariness, sparking into energy and abandon. I learned to drink and take drugs and dress for each night as if it was the first and last. I wanted to relive the posters on my wall to escape my origins. And yet I always wanted to go home. London, skewered on its own waterway, represented containment. But to set yourself free, you had only to get on a bus, one of the routes that might have been running since the city began. From the top seat of a trembling double-decker, the familiar panorama unfolds. Old Street to City Road, the Bank to St. Paul's, Blackfriars to the Thames. New shops and new skyscrapers rise, high water marks of the city's fortunes. Along this ramshackle route lies my history too. Bunhill Fields, a green refuge on a summer's afternoon, though under its turf lie the bones of William Blake and thousands of victims of the plague. Bart's Hospital, in whose Victorian interior I was operated on for a strange white patch that had begun to spread along my spine. The newspaper offices in Fleet Street, where I worked shifts wearing a cheap suit in the last empire of typewriters and alcohol. And Holborn Hill, where, in the opening of Bleak House, Dickens fantasized about a muddy city. As if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth. All along the way are monuments to forgotten men, their dreams disguised by voluminous beards and muscle-bound tritons, their scaly thighs rising out of the water that runs beneath the streets. It is strange to live in a place where rivers are forced to flow underground. Holborn itself means hollow bourn or brook, one of the streams that fed into the River Fleet. An artist, who also happens to be a diver, told me how, some years ago, he'd lived in a dank basement in Pimlico. The atmosphere of the place was almost oppressively cold and damp. He was reduced to wearing blocks of polystyrene on his boots to keep his feet warm. One day, he looked outside and saw that a large portion of the brick pavement had fallen away, like a piece of jigsaw puzzle, to reveal free-flowing water. not in a drain or a conduit, but with gravel like a proper riverbed. It was as if someone had punched a hole in the city's carapace. Like so many cities, Venice or Hong Kong, St. Petersburg or Mexico, or sacred sites such as Winchester, whose cathedral foundations were saved by the Edwardian diver William Walker, or Ely, the ship of the Fens, sailing on the marshes through which slither its eponymous eels, London is an illusion. It only floats on sand and clay. Nowhere is beyond the tidal reach. The river brings the sea into the city. Sometimes it might even be invited in, as it was at Sadler's Wells, whose aquatic theatre, which opened in 1804, was fed by the New River, itself a diverted waterway, and boasted a sunken tank measuring 90 feet long, 24 feet wide and 3 feet deep. Here one could witness the Siege of Gibraltar and Neptune's chariot drawn by seahorses, along with other perilous and appalling incidents. A woman falling from the rocks to be rescued by her lover. Sailors leaping from a vessel on fire. A child thrown in by its nurse who'd been paid to drown it, only for the infant to be rescued by a Newfoundland dog. So affecting were these scenes that at the end of a performance, members of the audience would jump into the water to assure themselves it was real. A theatre in which one could swim was remarkable even for the greatest city in the world, to be rivaled only by the Dolphinarium, which opened in Oxford Street in 1971. A murky green cellar pool, 12 feet deep, complete with swimsuit-clad aquamaids, a sea lion, a penguin, and a trio of dolphins named Sparky, Bonnie, and Brandy, who were prevailed upon to wear plastic hats and perform the usual tricks. The modern capital barely acknowledges the river, which was the reason for its being. The Thames was not embanked until the mid-19th century. You could not walk or ride along its banks, yet you could descend to the water via a series of steps marked on old maps. Temple Stairs, Essex Stairs, Arundel Stairs, Surrey Stairs, Salisbury Stairs, Whitehall Stairs. While street names such as the Strand commemorated what was once a beach. The river was much more present then. It seeped into the city, washed the feet of its buildings. Now the embankment oversees it with a wonderful disconnection, all those cars racing by, the trains rolling over its bridges, the commuters pacing to work, all turning their backs on the strong brown god as it surges through the city. It may be the colour of mud, swirling with silt and underlain with every kind of refuse, but I'm tempted to take to it. Like Benjamin Franklin, who, while working as a printer's apprentice near Lincoln's Inn Fields in 1725, would frequently plunge in. Franklin was obsessed with swimming. I had, from a child, been ever delighted with this exercise, he wrote in his autobiography. Had studied and practiced all Thevenet's motions and potions, added some of my own, aiming at the graceful and easy as well as the useful. Even on his way to England, watching porpoises, grampus and dolphins as his ship passed the Isle of Wight, Franklin jumped in and swam around the boat as if to join them. He even considered starting a swimming school in the city, before fate took him to other things. Sometimes, in the great stretches of my unemployed life, I'd get off the bus and walk the narrow alleys of the city, through the old Inns of Court and their silent celebration of privilege. The lanes led to Lincoln's Inn Fields. On one side of the square sits the Royal College of Surgeons. Its collection houses an array of glass cases, on whose shelves sit jars and bottles and boxes containing every imaginable body part, both human and animal. It's as though the world had been turned inside out, and into its constituent parts by their collector in whose honour the museum is named. John Hunter, born in Scotland in 1728, was a surgeon and anatomist who trained at Barts. As a fashionable doctor, John Hunter was in demand. His patients included an older and wiser Benjamin Franklin, now suffering with a bladder stone, and the future Lord Byron, whose birth he attended and for whose club foot he prescribed a corrective boot, advice which went unheeded by the poet's mother. In London, Hunter lived in a grand house on Leicester Square, but his country residence, to which he would drive in a cart pulled by a buffalo, was in Earl's Court, described by the Gentleman's Magazine as "about a mile beyond Brompton, in the midst of fields, a rural scene, inhabited by animals of the strangest selection in nature. Leopards and jackals lurked in dens, zebra and ostrich roamed the lawns, there were eagles chained to rocks, buffaloes in the stables, and giraffes nibbling the trees." Menageries had been part of London life since the 13th century, when King John kept his collection at the Tower, including Barbary lions and a polar bear which was allowed to fish in the Thames for its food while tethered by a long chain. In the 18th century, exotic animals excited a city alert to every new sensation. They were a kind of theatre. At the Change, as it was known, bonneted ladies and high-booted dandies were entertained by lions, tigers, monkeys, crocodiles, sea lions, rhinoceros, and even an Indian elephant named Chuni, all displayed in cages barely bigger than their captives' bodies and housed on the upper floor of a building on the Strand. Horses passing on the road below would rear up at the roars of the lions above, and a zebra was once ridden from there to Pimlico. Visitors included Jane Austen and Lord Byron. The latter recorded, "The elephant took and gave me my money again, took off my hat, opened a door, trunked a whip, behaved so well that I wish he were my butler." Touring Hunter's cabinet of medical curiosities, I'm most taken by the jars which contain the stomach linings of whales. So convoluted that it amazes me my own innards should be so formed, resembling as they do a cavern dense with stalagmites or the living extrusions of a reef. Our bodies are as unknown to us as the ocean, both familiar and strange. The sea inside ourselves. In 1783, a 21-foot female northern bottlenose whale, a strange bulbous-headed animal, one of the deep-diving beaked whales, was captured close to London Bridge, fatally far from home, and was acquired by the renowned whale oil merchant Alderman Pugh, who, as Hunter said, very politely allowed me to examine its structure and to take away the bones. This was the golden age of British whaling, and London was a whaling port, boasting the Greenland Dock, the largest of its kind in the world. Surrounded by refineries which supplied oil to light the capital streets, and whalebone to corset the fashionable men and women who strolled them.
Anthony Carf was reading From the Sea Inside by Philip Hoare. The producer was Duncan Mitchell. Coming next, the Shipping Bulletin.